So this week is Parshat Toldot, 5779. Two of our boys had bar mitzvahs on Parshat Toldot. So theoretically I know this one, but I don't.
Theoretically they know. I think they do.
We're going to primarily focus on Perek Kav Zayin. Perek Kav Zayin, for those of you who don't remember, is towards the end of the Parsha. This is the dramatic scene where Yitzchak wants to give a bracha to his children, or at least to one of his children. And there's so many things to say about this, so I want to try to focus on one of two things. Just by way of introduction, I think the proper way to understand this parsha is to understand the various relationships that take place. So how many relationships are there? So I think if you count properly, it comes out to 10. And you're probably thinking, so how did I get to 10? So I get to 10 because you have Yitzchak and Rivka, right? So that's one. Then you have Rivka and Yaakov. You have Rivka and Esav. You have Yitzchak and Yaakov, Yitzchak and Esav. You have Yaakov and Esav. And then you have all of those and the inverse of them. It's not just Yitzchak and Rivka, it's also Rivka and Yitzchak. Which means, are all of those relationships absolutely parallel, or does each side of relationship see the other one in the same way that the first one sees them? Which is why I'll say it again, that there's probably 10 different perspectives to identify over here, and we're not going to do all of them. Okay? Just to get that out of the way. Because a lot of that is towards the beginning of the parasha. The other thing that we know going into this is that, you know, we have more knowledge than at least some of the protagonists do. And how many of those protagonists, that's also, I think, one of the questions, because Rivka does have inside information. Well, at least at the point she gets it, it's inside information. Eventually the boys are born. And what does she know? She knows that she's carrying twins, which means, I don't know, and the Mefarshim debate this point, when she's troubled and she goes to seek God for it, which actually goes a long way to tell us about Rivka. I don't know how many characters we had in Tanakh prior to this that something troubles them and then they feel this need to go and to seek God. And that's what she does. They're, meaning, we don't know how she grew up. We don't know what she learned when she went to Beis Yaakov. Well, she didn't go to Beis Yaakov. Dina went to Beis Yaakov. But she, what did she learn in the house of Betuel? Meaning, what was her religious beliefs? Did she believe in one God or whatever? So it's very interesting. She gets here, meaning she gets to the Yitzchak family. She marries Yitzchak. She moves in Sarah's tent. We don't know that much about her at that point, but then it says, "Vatelech l'drosh et Hashem." So she goes looking, which means she believes there's one God, Hashem, Yudke Vavke Haya Hova Viya, and she goes to seek out God. That goes a long way in terms of telling us, you know, who she is. And then we have God responding to her, and that response is going to be very, very significant. We touched last week a little bit about how the commentaries debate whether God actually spoke to her directly or indirectly. I think that there's two different components that make this challenging for the commentators. One of them is Vatelech, that she went. Vatelech would indicate, although it doesn't have to, it would indicate some kind of a geographical. So I could just as easily say, Vatelech, you know, she went, she was a Breslover, and she went into the forest, and she was doing Hisbodudus in the forest, and she was talking to God in the forest, which, by the way, sounds pretty similar to what Yitzchak does. So you could say that. In the beginning of last week's parasha, when it says that Avraham came to mourn his wife, Vayavo Avram l'spod l'sarah ulevakosa. So there as well, did Avram come geographically from someplace else, or is it just a turn of phrase? And again, the commentaries debate that point. But if I say the Vatelech l'dro, she went, so that's what has, that's when we have, you know, there's like, you know, you play cards, there's an ace or something, that, or a joker. So the joker in Bereishis is the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Ever, right? Whenever you need to know where somebody went, okay, they were in yeshiva, they were learning. It's like today, so it's like the ultimate alibi. Where were they? Oh, I'm in yeshiva. Okay, so therefore they claim. Okay, so where did she go? She had to go to Shem Ve'Ever. Of course, there were other options. One option could be, why don't you go? You know, Yitzchak is an interesting, okay, and then there's Avraham. which means it's almost like deliberately not to go to Avram, which is itself, as I said, there's a lot there. But she receives inside information saying that you have twins, which, as I said, maybe she knows, maybe she doesn't know at this point. She has twins. And the twins are going to be two different people. They're going to be two different nations. They're not going to work together. They're going to be two different nations, and the younger one is the one who's going to be successful. So right there we have a problem. I know, and I've said some of this before. I know some of you, and you're the kind of people who, before you read a book, you look at the very end of the book to see how it ends up, to see if you want to be get emotionally involved. And some of you shaking your head no, some of you shaking your head yes. I saw in the news last week that there were these two scientists that were someplace in some far-flung place, and one of them kept ruining, was telling him, the other guy, every book he would read how it ends, and he stabbed him in the end. Right? I know people like who would behave like this as, I know people who would behave like this as well. Right. Yeah. Or you don't want to get emotionally involved in a movie unless you know it's going to have a happy ending or not. As I said, Rivka here knows how the story ends. So, without going into the Yaakov and Esav as young people and how they were brought up, and as I said, a lot of this we've covered before, we now want to move over to Perek Kaf Zayin, which of course has in the background all of the other pieces of information. V'yihi ki zaken Yitzchak v'tichena einav miraot. When Yitzchak became old and he was no longer able to see, and I would assume that that's a question of old age. I've seen people who've made claims, no, Yitzchak was blind his whole life, and so on. There's a medrash, it's from the Akedah. But to say that his whole life he was blind, I think is quite difficult in terms of the pshat. But Yikra et Esav b'no hagadol. Now, right there you have to stop. I don't know why I didn't bold that one. I could have or I should have. He calls Esav b'no hagadol. So what does b'no hagadol mean in this particular? Does it mean his tall son? His heavy son? Does it mean his older son? If it really means his older son, that's quite funny. The reason why it's quite funny, it's like twins who say, okay, you know, which one? Okay, he's my older brother. By how much? By 2 minutes. They're twins. To call one b'no hagadol, it's also interesting, his older son, v'yomilav b'ni, v'yomilav hineni. V'yomer hineni zakanti, lo yadati yomoti, I don't know when I'm going to die, which is really interesting that all those years before, when Esav comes in the field, oh, I'm going to die, so here he's projecting something that maybe he hears, does his father always speak this way? Or again, no, now he's old, so he speaks this way. V'tasana kelecha telicha ukashtecha, go and take your tools of hunting, and go to the field and go hunt for me. So again, those who have claimed, like Rav Hirsch, who we're not going to talk about every year, who have claimed that Yitzchak and Rivka did terrible parenting, here we see wonderful parenting at the hands of Yitzchak, because what does he do? He sees that his son has a particular skill, which is not necessarily the most Jewish behavior. And those of you who don't know, you can take a look at the tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda about this, where he deals with hunting. It's a very famous tshuva. He deals with hunting and Tzar Bale Chaim. And one, along the way he says, not a Jewish thing. Like who's asking this question? Who goes hunting? Esav goes hunting. Well, Esav, I don't know if he was Jewish. He had Jewish parents. But, you know, it's not a Jewish thing. But think about what Yitzchak just now did. Yitzchak is taking Esav's skill, and he just now told him, as a mitzvah, please go and do this thing which you like to do. So he just now turned his hobby into a mitzvah. Those of you who think that, oh, the only way that he has the ability of giving a bracha is if he has already given, first he needs to eat, right? A lot of people can't do, right? You can't give a bracha, you can't do anything in the morning until you have coffee. Yitzchak couldn't give a bracha till he ate. But is that really true? Do you remember later on he summons Yaakov in and he says, and he wants to give Yaakov a bracha before he goes away? Did he ask him to bring him food? Did he say, I need to make a bracha before? No. Did I need to eat something before? No. Which means this is the way he treats Esav. This is not, meaning this says more about his relationship with Esav than it does say about Yitzchak per se in terms of his own personal needs. And therefore those commentaries who anyone want to take it in a different way, I just don't see it. It's that, no, this is what Esav does. And you know we have this thing in the back of our heads that Esav kept the mitzvah kivud of aim. So I've pointed out before that I can't figure out any place that he has any positive relationship with his mother. There's nothing there. He actually is not Gores his mother. I don't know how to say that in English. She's not there. Here is one of the little pieces of evidence. When he marries his two Canaanite wives, so it says that this was something which caused bitterness for his mother and his father. Both of them were really quite troubled by this. It's at the very end of Perek Avav that you do not have in front of you. It says, Vatiyena morot ruach liyitzchak ulirivka. It's something which troubled both of his parents terribly. Later on, towards the end of this week's parsha, Vayar Esav kiraot benot kanan be'enei Yitzchak aviv. And Esav sees his father dislikes or is very disappointed with his choice of marriage. It doesn't say his mother. He does not care how his mother thinks. Now, of course, the psychologists among us, or the amateur psychologists who are far more dangerous, could say, knowing this inside information, when Rivka nursed her children, did she nurse them the same way? Did she hold them in her arms the exact same way? Or no, the bottle. Did she treat them both the same way? When Esav went to his therapist, did he say, I don't know, from the earliest time I just felt my mother didn't love me? And I'm saying again, it could be true. I'm not saying this is a conscious thing. Is that Rivka knows that Yaakov is the one. So how does that then impact the whole childhood and the way that he feels? Does Esav sense this? But I will say, did you all notice what we just now saw? Both of his parents are disappointed, but he's only troubled that his father's disappointed. So all of those who say that Esav kept the mitzvah of kivud av aim, I just have to take one word out of that aim, right? He kept the mitzvah of kivud av. But now realize what Yitzchak did. Yitzchak's a wonderful father. How did Yitzchak get him to keep the mitzvah kivud av? He asked him to do that which he wanted to do. He's a hunter, so please hunt for me. I'm saying that's really wonderful parenting by saying this is what this kid's skill set is, so let me ask him to do it. Please bring me food. Please take care of me. Please. So therefore, again, Yitzchak is a wonderful father. We just don't know about the Rivka-Esav relationship. Again, some of the commentaries, there's one other verse that she says, you know, please go away, she says to Yaakov, or you both may die the same day. So some point out there that there is some motherly love for Esav. It's her son. She may have one preference, or she may know the future, and how knowing that future impacts things. That, again, is going to be the exact challenge that we have. But, you know, from the very beginning, we have a wonderful amount of dysfunctionality, and there is a lack of symmetry between the various relationships over here. And all of, by the way, I taught this yesterday to my college students, and I said, and so how many of you have other siblings? Most raise their hands. And how many of you feel that your parents love one of your siblings more? Almost all the hands went up. I said, okay, so now I know what I'm dealing with over here. Right? How many of you are the favorite ones? So then a couple of hands go up. But it's fascinating. Forget about truth right now. Forget about truth. It's a question of perception. I mean, look, listen, I know my parents like me more than my siblings, okay? I happen to know that. Who do you like most, right? I drove my mother crazy kid. I said, who do you like the most? But I did this just because I knew that was a good way of torturing her. I love all my children. The same? Yes, the same. Exactly the same? Anyway. Yes, I was that terrible child. Correct? Correct. No. Yeah. So we have something interesting over here, and let's go back again from the beginning, because something interesting just took place. But Yikra is Esav Benoha Gadol. He calls Esav his older son, and he tells him, okay, go out, take your tools, go and hunt. So that I can bless you. So Yitzchak just now told us a mouthful. The only way that he can bless Esav is Esav becomes deserving of the blessing. The only way he comes deserving of his blessing is if somehow he takes his hunting and transforms his hunting into something which is positive. And the way he transforms it into something which is positive is by virtue of doing the mitzvah of kivud av with this. This, by the way, tells us a great deal about Yitzchak, and I'll say one more thing that it tells us before we're able to move further. What is the information that Rivka knows that Yitzchak doesn't know? Namely, that they are twins. Okay, that Yitzchak finds that out eventually. And what's the second piece of information that she knows? That they will become two different nations. So now, if that's what she knows, what doesn't Yitzchak know? That they will become two different nations. So therefore, what's Yitzchak's plan for them? It's obvious that they should be together. They're one family. Which means Yitzchak teaches them, you're one family. I also ask my students this. How many of your parents told you you always need to look out for your siblings? And again, a great deal of the hands went up. That family is family. And then I asked them, how many of them behave with their own siblings that way? Because it's what we say and what we do is more important than what we say. And again, that's important. And not that all situations are exactly the same, but Yitzchak, by default, do you like the way I'm making all of my assumptions over here? Yitzchak, by default, believes that they are family, that they are brothers, and that they will always be brothers, and that not just that they're one nation, of course they're one nation, but they're one family. Now, he also sees something else. This you can't miss. He sees that one of his sons is really reminiscent of Avram Avinu, or at least a part of Avram Avinu. The part of Avram who sits in the tents, and the part is of Avram, because Avram also knew how to go to war. Avram also had a tough side of him, which sometimes we forget. Although, if I had to look at the two sons, and just in terms of the language, the one who's connected to tents till this point in the Torah is Avraham. The one who's connected to hunting till this point in the Torah is Nimrod. Okay, that's a challenging thing. Look at that. Genetics are interesting. That Avraham and, that Rivka and Yitzchak have a child who is going to remind them of Nimrod and Avraham. I mean, that's, you talk about, trying to make a movie, the nemesis just shows up in your house. Now, what do you do with this? So Yitzchak apparently has this unbelievable, beautiful thought, and it goes something like this. What would have happened, go back in history, what would have happened if Avraham and Nimrod could have joined forces? What would have happened to the world at that point? And obviously he thinks the world would have been transformed. The power of Nimrod, the decency of Avraham, together, you're basically talking about a messianic age. And he looks at his kids, and he sees that the two of these kids can work together, and you can have a messianic age. And of course, Yitzchak is right, because the messianic age is described when the children of Esav come back, and they become the helpers of the children of Yaakov. But that's what Yitzchak sees. Of course, Yitzchak always sees the future. Why does he always see the future? Yitzchak. Yitzchak is a future tense. It's not laughter in the past tense. Really should have been, right? Tzachaka Sarah. She laughed. So his name should have been a reminder of the laughter that Sarah once had, or the laughter that Avram once had, but it's not. The form of Yitzchak is the future. The laughter will be in the future because Yitzchak is future-oriented. He sees the way it's going to turn out. Of course, he doesn't realize that the way it's going to turn out is not going to be in his lifetime, and it's not going to be in many, many lifetimes afterwards. It's a far-flung future which he sees, and he's right about what he sees. It just doesn't happen at that particular point. So I hope a lot of this now is falling into line, is that we see how Yitzchak sees Esav, and we also know how Yitzchak sees Yaakov. And how do I know that? And I'll say it again. When he calls Yaakov in towards the end of the parasha, and he says, bring me food? No. Right? Do I need food? No. Just what does he say to him? He immediately gives him a couple of very potent blessings. He says to him, right away, he calls him and he blesses him. No preamble, he blesses him. And then he gives him a mitzvah as well. And realize this is the point that Esav has already failed. Why do I say Esav has failed in this point? Because in the very beginning of the parasha, we're told that Yitzchak was 40 years old when he got married. He's 40 years old when he gets married, and he's 60 years old when the boys are born. One of the things that, despite everything they've ever taught you, that we have no idea of is how old Rivka was. The whole assumption that she was 3 years old is because she was born the moment of the Akedah, which is very, very difficult to claim. Just read the Pesukim there. And there's also a claim that Yitzchak was 37 years old. The text of the Akedah does not sound like a 37-year-old. It sounds like somebody considerably younger. And for that matter, the text by the well does not sound like a 3-year-old. It sounds like somebody considerably older. Yeah. So I'm just saying it's funny. And there's reasons to make the claims that they made, and I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to say we don't know how old she was. We do know that there's 20 years go by of infertility. We don't know. You know what? Let's say, again, I'll go with any number you give me. I'm happy. You want to say that she was 10 years old when they got married? Okay. There were some of your grandparents that got married at 10 years old. or great-grandparents, as it were, who got married at young ages. By the way, it doesn't mean that they lived as husband and wife when they were younger. And the 20 years of infertility is actually interesting when you don't know how long it may have been before she was even capable of having children, and so on and so forth. But part of what I'm responding to, I just saw some educators have a discussion. Are we concerned about charges of pedophilia against Yitzchak? And it's just so silly. It's just so silly. You take a midrash and then you turn the midrash into reality, and then that's the reality that you teach and you have to live. Why? It's not there. It's not there, and it doesn't fit very well into the psukim either. So I'll say it again. 20 years go by, and 20 years of infertility is a long time, especially when this is the future, and they know this. So there's this test which is taking place here as well. Eventually, this, again, we have the two children, and now let's go back to Yaakov for a moment. He calls Yaakov in, and he blesses him without any preamble. He tells him to go get a wife. So what I started to say about him being 40 years old, what does Esav do, who honors his father? He gets married when he's 40 years old. Do you realize the superficiality of that honoring his father? Oh, my father's 40, I'll be 40. I mean, it's just a superficial outward behavior. Esav is very concerned to be like his father. You know, this follows the whole section of Yitzchak wanting to be like his father. But what did Yitzchak do to be like his father? He did something deep. What was deep, what he did? He dug wells. He dug the wells, and he renamed the wells the way his father did. So we know very little about Yitzchak, but what do you know? That he was very, very dedicated to his father. He's the one who's passing on the tradition. It's a challenge for us to understand Yitzchak because there's a lot less narrative about Yitzchak. But what do we know? He's dedicated to his father. He redigs the wells. Esav's takeaway from all this is, I need to be like my father now. There's substance and then there's the superficial level of it. What's the substance? Well, where did his father get a wife? His father did not marry somebody who's local. And that's part of the whole previous narrative, which I would like to assume Esav had heard at some point. Remember, Avram Avinu dies when the two of them are 15 years old. Presumably they meet Avraham and they sit on his knee and he tells them about the old days. He tells them about Nimrod. I mean, just think about that for a second. Here you have Avram teaching, telling the old stories about him and Nimrod and having the two kids, one coming out like Avraham and then one deciding to be like Nimrod. I don't know, what would our Freudian psychologist say about this? I'm saying just realizing that he knows Avraham just makes that whole thing far more interesting. According to the Midrash, don't accuse me of contradicting myself, but I will bring the Midrash. According to the Midrash, the day that Esav had his breakdown and he said to Yaakov, please give me food, was the day that Avraham had died. Which means dealing with death, or the first death of somebody that he loved, and I would like to believe that he loved, is what causes his complete breakdown. So now, going back a second, we have Yaakov, who is very Avraham-like. And that could be conscious. It could be because he knew Avraham, because he wants to be like Avraham. Who would not want to be like a grandfather like Avraham? Yitzchak, on the other hand, his job is to pass on the Mesorah. That's what he does. He redigs the same wells. He's concerned with tradition. Esav is superficial. And the second point about Esav is not just that he marries a Canaanite. He immediately takes two wives. The person in the Torah before this that we see taking two wives right away was Lemech. Lemech took two wives, and the Midrash, again, attacks him for this and says he had one wife was his beautiful wife, and one wife was the one for children, which means that the man is absolutely misogynist because he sees woman in terms of utility, right? What can this woman do for me, and what can this woman do for me? It's not the same woman who's the mother of his children, who's also his lover and also his best friend and also the one who he wants with him all the time. No, you're with the children, you stay home. You come out with me because you're the good-looking one, which means this is totally looking at women in terms of their utility, what they can do for him. I mean, today we're much more developed. We're not primitive like them, so we don't take two wives at once. We generally do this one after the other. We have one and have children, and then we move on to the other one. So, because we've developed a lot over history. But that's what Lemech did. Unless what? Unless you're a Bedouin. Okay. That's your only response to this. Esav right away takes two wives. So not only does it show superficiality, but it shows superficiality on top of his superficiality, which means he has to be 40 years old, just like his father, but he takes two wives, which just shows really, I mean, do I have to stress the sexism or everything else involved in this? Both of his wives were like the original members of the Me Too movement. You don't see that. But they're Canaanites. So over here, the thing that the thing that Yitzchak commands Esav to do is bring me food. The thing that he commands Yaakov to do is go far away and bring and marry a proper wife. And don't you realize that that's a slap in the face to Esav? So the other thing that he says right after he sends him away and says to get a proper wife, Pasuk Gimel, you don't have this in front of you. It's quite mysterious if you ever get to what you have in front of you. On Perek Kav Chet, Pasuk Gimel says, V'kel Shakai Yivarechotcha. And God, but he calls God in the name of Shin Dalad Yud. You know that name is connected to the mezuzah, protection. It's also a name which is connected to the Brit Milah. It's the name which is first introduced in the Torah when Avram was commanded to get the Brit Milah. That's already a little foreshadowing because it tells you what's going to happen next. Because he's saying the covenant that God had with Avraham, which was created when Avraham became Avraham, and when he was commanded to have a Brit Milah, and he became the first Jew, right? That's the name that he's using right now, so that's really significant. And he says, you will become this great nation, which sounds like he finally understands that there are, in fact, two different nations. V'yitain lachad birkat Avraham, lachal lazaracha, and he says to him, you will receive birkat Avraham, and then you and your descendants, l'rishtacha et eretz mugurecha, asher natana l'kim l'Avraham, and I'm giving you Eretz Israel. Which means when I ask, what's the Yitzchak-Yaakov relationship? Yeah, it's real simple. He knows 100% that Yaakov is like Avraham. He knows that. Okay, so now let's go back again. What doesn't he know going into this whole bracha scene? He doesn't know yet that they're two different nations. That's going to become apparent. He believes that Esav has the ability of becoming those who will take care of Yaakov's physical world. They're the ones who will take care of, right? They will partner. They will work together. They will be one. That's what he thinks, and that's what Rivka knows is not true. Now, let's continue back in source number one. Pasuk Hey, V'Rivka Shoma'at, which is, of course, beautiful because Rivka always hears. She's not the only one with a great sense of hearing. There's another person who, if we'll have time, we'll get to him as well. Somebody else who hears very well, and we're actually a little concerned about his hearing. Okay, I'll tell you who he is. And that's Lavan. It's her brother. So, and it's actually interesting to think about Lavan for a moment because, you know, we have this thing in the back of our minds which Rashi quotes later on in Shemot, and that is that there is a tendency, or at least it occurs sometimes, that children could be like the mother's brothers or brother. So that children could end up in taking traits from the mother's brother. Right, Rashi brings that when Aaron got married and he marries Elisheva, and it says Elisheva, the sister of Nachshon. So Rashi there says, why is it Nachshon to know the children? So I've used that to explain, what does Nachshon do? He's impetuous and he goes jumping into the water first. What do her children do? They're impetuous. Which children? Nadav and Avihu, and they never ask, and they go jumping ahead, and therefore there was a little bit foreshadowing in that Rashi in terms of the behavior of Nadav and Avihu. Coming back over here, I could have thought that Esav would have a little bit of Lavan in him. And I'm somewhat convinced he has no Lavan in him. I mean, Lavan is very conniving. Esav isn't conniving. Esav is like a bull. I mean, Esav is very straightforward. In fact, it's interesting because his father is also very straightforward. But their straightforwardness is in different directions. Yitzchak is Midat Hadin, and again, there's this very direct, there's no slyness. Rivka has a lot of Lavan in her as well. Again, they use this in different ways. Lavan is the other one who constantly hears things. But let's continue, because there's much more to this than I'm even beginning to hint at right now. Rivka shomad b'daber Yitzchak el Esav b'no. You love that? B'no? What do I want from her? I don't want anything from her. I am making a reference to the author and editor of the book in the way that the relationship is described. Esav Bino, it didn't have to say Esav Bino, which means the editor, right? The editor could have written something else here, but this is very telling in terms of the relationship. V'rivka shomat b'der Yitzchak esav b'no. V'yelech esav has... Right. Good. So now you realize there were many other ways, and the fact that I'm noting this is because it happens to be I'm correct right now. Okay? Right. It could be Bina, it could be Nam, it could have nothing. Continue. He goes, V'rivka amra el Yaakov Bina. I'll say this again. The dysfunctionality in this family is staring at you when you look, and right now it's introduced, well, there was also this thing about Bino Hagadol, and then there was, which actually gives you reason to believe that part of what's going on over here is a birthright. It's an issue of a birthright. That he's calling in the older son because the older son is the Bechor. And that's why it mentions till this point. I'm just saying that may well be in the background. And Shemati Tavicha Medaber El Esev Achicha. So it's also interesting because, as I said, that's another relationship that we need to know about. The relationship between El Esev Achicha. So if you hear the relationship between Yaakov and Esav is quite important, but Rivka describes, there's a tenderness to that word. The complexity of this whole scene, so far what we're getting, when I said that there are 10 different relationships taking place, the reason why I'm mentioning that is because we can't understand this chapter without understanding those relationships, and then not all of them are going to be the way that you think they are. They're going to be, I think, maybe more complex. So she then says, bring me food and so on, and then Shel tells the whole story. Pasuk Tes, get the food, and I'll make it for your father, La'avicha, as he loves, which is also interesting. The love is interesting. The love of Yitzchak, we know that he loves Rivka, we know that he loves Esav, and we know that he loves his food, which is very interesting. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Yaakov says, Hein Esav Achi, again, there's a tenderness there. Esav, my brother, he's hairy, he looks different from me, my father may touch me, and so on. V'heveta alai klala v'lo bracha. And my father then will bring upon me a curse, and I will then have brought upon me a curse and not a blessing. Now, what's really interesting here is what it doesn't say. And what it doesn't say, actually, this is like really the only thing which is really new this week for me. Maybe for you, every word I'm saying is new, but for me, the only thing which is really new is noticing that. Not noticing what it says, but it's noticing what it doesn't say. He's afraid that this thing, that he will be found out. And when it's found out that it's not going to work, he's not going to get a blessing, he's going to end up being cursed. What is he not afraid of? And what else is he not afraid of? He's not afraid of Esav. And I would have thought Esav, with his reputation, you know, he's quick with a knife, he's tough, he's big, he's strong, he murders and he rapes and he does all kinds of other groovy things. I would have thought that he'd be terrified of Esav, but he's not. He's only terrified, and he says to his mother, you want to get the blessing. I may not get blessed from this. I may end up getting cursed. So that itself is really interesting. And as I said, that may tell us far more than anything else over here. But hold on to that. But Tomer lo imo, and his mother says, Alai kililatcha bini. Any curse which is coming will come to me. Now, I do have to stop here for a moment. There's really two problems. One problem, which if anybody's really interesting, I wrote an essay on this, which is in Hebrew, or as close as I can do to it. If you want to read it, I'll send it to you. And can you really steal a bracha? Can you imagine saying, okay, you steal the bracha. Okay, God, you got to bless me now. I stole the bracha. Really? Really? God works for us now? Now we can get God to give us a bracha because we made him? We're like, what are you talking about? How in the world can you steal a bracha? How is that supposed to work? And the flip side of that is Yaakov's afraid that he's going to get cursed. His mother, no, don't worry. Alai. It's on me. I got it. Yeah? And how do you know that? And on top of all that, there's another question, which I think will actually end up having a very simple answer. What in the world is Rivka doing? Where is this coming from? How does she know that this is the right, this is the ethical behavior? My guess would be, which I think is the obvious thing that all of you should hopefully have thought of as well, it's based upon the same inside information that she had from the very beginning. She knows that this second son is the son who will be successful, and therefore that's the son who's the one who should be the beneficiary of the blessing. Now, there's another part to this, and the other part to this may very well be that she also knows something else, and here again I have to pause. Did she ever share this information with anybody? Did she ever share this with Yitzchak? And apparently the answer to that is no. Did she ever share this information with Yaakov? And that's a far more intriguing question. If she did share it with Yaakov, then I just want you to think this through for a second. Yitzchak's approach is that Esav's role is to be the hunter, the provider, to find food, to cook food, and to prepare the food. And Yaakov's job is to be the spiritual person, just like Yitzchak is the spiritual person. So therefore, the scene that we had over here, that if Esav wants his bracha, what does Esav need to do to deserve his bracha? He needs to hunt, and he needs to get the food, he needs to prepare the food, and he needs to bring it to Yaakov. And the day that Esav comes in from the field, well, actually, he came in from the field, apparently, empty-handed. Because if he came in with anything from his hunt, then he should have... I mean, how hard is it when you come in after having hunted food to kill the animal, again, if you're Esav, and then put something on the grill, put it on the fire? How long... Meaning, what exactly his... So apparently, and I know that none of you want to think about this, but our great uncle Esav may not have been a very good hunter. Why did he come in empty-handed? More than that, why is he turning to Yaakov and saying to Yaakov, you take care of me? At that moment that he says to Yaakov, you take care of me, at that moment Yaakov realizes that his father is wrong and his mother is right. Because his father has been saying, no, you're going to be one people, and he's going to take care of you, he's the hunter, he's going to bring the food, he's going to take care of all the gashmiut, and you're the one who will be taking care of the ruchniut. And Rivka says, forget about it, your brother's a loser, it's never going to happen, your brother's not going to live up to his responsibilities. And at the moment that Esav comes in and asks him for his food, he realizes that his mother was right. So then he says to his brother, okay, so sell me the firstborn, which from Esav's perspective is the best deal he ever made in his life. Because Esav does not want that responsibility. Esav is tired, he's depressed, he can't live up to his father's expectations. His father thinks he's something that he's not. He's not going to be part of the Yaakov family. He's not going to be part of this. He doesn't want these responsibilities. Vayivez Esav et habechora. He detests the responsibilities, or if you want, the privileges. What is it? He detests being the firstborn. Yaakov did him incredible favor when he took the firstborn from him, and I want to use that as the answer which I raised before. Yaakov thinks that him and Esav have an understanding. They get one another. Yaakov has taken off of Esav all this responsibility that he has, and Esav should be thankful and has been thankful for many years to this. But if you want a little bit more insight into the Esav personality, it's immediate gratification. Give me the food. Right now, I'm going to die. You're not going to die. It's okay. A young person like you can go without food for a little bit more. Nothing's going to happen. You have this immediacy. He needs it right now. So having responsibility, which is not going to pay off for a very long time, is something which Esav is so happy that Yaakov took for him. I'm willing to go so far with this that when Yaakov walks in and Yitzchak says, who are you? He says, I am Esav, your firstborn. Because it's true. I have taken the responsibilities of Esav, your firstborn. He has subcontracted with me to take over all of those responsibilities. So Yaakov walking in to take the bracha going to Esav, as far as he's concerned, he's not afraid of Esav. With Esav, it's a very short conversation. I took this from you. I did you a favor. And Esav's response, I think for all the years, has been absolutely, 100%. But again, what's Esav? It's a comedic gratification. Right now he's about to get a blessing from his father, and now he wakes up and realizes, what have I done? Which means Esav has seller's regret. But now, much, much later, he has the seller's regret. And says, hold it, what in the world did I do? And now, who does he point at? It's easy, he can point a finger at himself. What did I do? But instead, what does he do? Look what Yaakov has done. Yaakov's taking this from Yitro. But I think from Yaakov's perspective, and I'll say it again, Yaakov has no fear of Esav. Yaakov, see, this may be part of Yaakov's naivete. He's convinced Esav loves him. He loves Esav. Should I say that again? He loves Esav. He just knows that this is not what Esav wants. So he says, I will help you. And his helping, again, this is not Yaakov, as some anti-Semites may want him to say, Jewing him out of this. No. This is Yaakov taking the responsibility that Esav does not want, and Yaakov does this out of a sense of devotion to his brother and saying, this is hard for you, I will take care of you. And therefore, to walk in front of his father, you realize now there's something else going on? He doesn't want to break his father's heart and tell his father that his brother's a loser. He's willing to not just have taken Esav's spot all those years ago, he's willing to continue to take Esav's spot, but he doesn't want his father to be disappointed in Esav. So over here, again, you can accuse me now of this unbelievable cover-up to save Yaakov's reputation, but what's my evidence for all this? Did I have any evidence? He's not afraid of Esav. How can you not be afraid of Esav? And what's my answer? They have a deal, but it's not a deal that Esav should have felt he's being taken advantage of. Vayivez Esav et habechora. Esav was ecstatic. He got rid of the thing which was weighing on him so heavily, which was making him depressed. How can I possibly live up to my father's expectations? Yaakov releases him from all this and says, I'll do it. I'll take this role. Because he doesn't... Okay, so I'm going to say from Yaakov's perspective, I think because he doesn't want to break his father's heart to ever know that Esav is what Esav really is. Right. I think part of this also is, you talk about Avraham Avinu, it's the covenant. It's the slavery for 400 years. You get Eretz Yisrael, but a long, long, long time from now. And again, I don't know in Yitzhak's mind if that was ever on the table. I don't know exactly what was on the table. All that I see Yitzhak wanting to give Esav a bracha with, which is a lot of gashmiut, a lot of physical things and a lot of power as well. Let's read, because he is afraid that you can't take a bracha. He's right about this, by the way. You can't take a bracha. And he's afraid that by fooling his father, and sometimes he can have the best possible intentions, it may nonetheless not be the proper way to treat Yitzchak. And to protect his father, but it still may not be.
But look at what his children.
Right. Okay, we'll come back to that hopefully before we finish. Too big of a parsha. Notice now, move a little bit further. Pasuk Tekvah. Vatikav Rivkat b'gdei Esav bina hagadol hachamudot asheita b'bayit v'tolbashet Yaakov bina hakatan. So again, you're dealing with a difference in age by a couple of minutes. And the older, the bigger, the younger. For me, all of this is an echo of the prophecy that she has. The older and the younger. The tsa'ir, right? And the reason why this keeps coming up over here is that from Rivka's perspective, all of this flows from the original prophecy that she has. One more point to get to. According to the Medrash, that he would put on special clothing when he would go to see his father. He would put on nice clothing, but he would keep them in the house. There's all kinds of things about his wives, and they make up all kinds of midrashim. They wouldn't take care of his clothing. They wouldn't do the laundry. Why? Me do the laundry? Let the other wife do the laundry. Anyway. you thought, okay, anyway. You thought there's an upside to this? See, there you go. She's thinking the same thing. Okay. This, when Esav finds out about it, Pasuk Mem Aleph, V'yistom Esav et Yaakov al habracha asher bercho aviv, V'yomer Esav bil libo, he says in his heart, when my father is dead, I'm going to kill Yaakov. And I love that pasuk, actually. I'll read it. V'yomer Esav bil libo, yikurvu yimei evil avi, v'harga et Yaakov achi. Right? It's the achi, meaning the relationship is constantly stressed in this whole parsha over here, or this whole section over here, and this sense of brotherhood. I do believe that Yaakov feels a sense of brotherhood, and I think that Esav has always felt brotherhood, but until now. Now this has pushed him over. Next pasuk, Membet. Now Esav said this in his heart, Vayugad l'Rivka d'vei Esav. So Vayugad. So Vayugad is very interesting. She was told, El Esav bina hagadol. Again, the stress is bina hagadol over here, and I'm overstating this, but all this was not necessary. Every time the description, again and again. So this is the bina hagadol who was rejected in her original prophecy that she had received. Vatishlach vatikra leYaakov bina hakatan. Right. She then goes and summons Yaakov bina hakatan. So I'll say it one more time. This all takes me back to that original prophecy that she has, that there are two sons, but the younger one is the one, and that's why this is stressed this way the whole time. So let's look in our other three pages what we can possibly get to today. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, we'll look at it one more time. When that's the pasuk that she says, whatever curse will come on me. Onkelus in Yud Gimel says, Vamart le'ime alai itmar binevuah. That I've been, and this is strange for Onkelus because he generally translates word for word literally. Source 3, Pasuk Yud Gimel in the Targum. Va'amr le'ime alai itmar binevuah. D'lo yiton levata alaych. I was told in a prophecy, you will not be cursed. Now, which prophecy is this? Is this the same original prophecy, or is she having another prophecy at this point? The Targum Yonatan over here. No, not in that pasuk. When she's told, that's pasuk Membet in the Targum in source 3, v'itchaval l'rifka yatpid gamal eisav. She was told, it became known to her, v'yugad, it became known to her. The Targum Yonatan over here says, she was told, b'ruach HaKodesh. So he turns this into another prophecy which has taken place. Rashi brings that as well in Source 6, Vayugad, Beruach HaKodesh. The Radak also says this, that she was a Navi. So of course, a Navi, a Niviah, Navi is Navi. That's what they do. Source number 10 is interesting because remember we talked about her brother? Vayugad lilavan b'yom hashlishi ki barach Yaakov. So who told him? Vayugad. We have the exact same word. Onkelus translates it the same way. Vayugad in source 12, vayitchava lilavan. The Targum Yonatan, who there earlier had said it was Ruach HaKodesh, so now by Rivka, we'll look at the way it's phrased in 14 in the Hebrew, of Acharesha, Halach Yaakov, Amdu haro'im ala be'er, v'lo matzumayim, v'yamtinu shloshe yamim, shema tiyem mutzefet v'lo tzafa, u'bekach bo l'lovin, v'yom l'shilshi v'edak, ki azev Yaakov, shebizchuto haita mutzefet esrim shanim. That, what happened? The water stopped flowing from the Be'er, and therefore they came to this realization after 3 days and said, oh, it must be. So it's also interesting. He turns a supernatural event here in order to be the indication, or the cessation of a supernatural event. Later on, though, Lavan, when he catches up with them, in Surah 16, Yesh le'el yadi la'soti machem ra, ve'lohei avichem emesh amar elai. Here he said, I actually did have, God came and spoke to me. So it's very interesting, the Lavan Rivka comparisons over here. But there's one more that I wanted to note, and that was in Source 17. And once again, you need to notice what's not here. Although, you know what, maybe I'll just say two things about this. One is in Source, the continuation of Source 16 on the top of page 3, that he accuses them of stealing the trafim of his gods, and he says whoever took them will die, which is very interesting from Yaakov, because I never thought about this before, but he's actually channeling his mother. And I know that his mother said the curse will be upon me, but it's standing up and saying something which a great deal of confidence. Now the only question is what kind of negative implications this ended up causing. In Source 17, we're going to again look at what it doesn't say. God tells him, go back home. Now, his mother had said, go away for a couple of days, yomim achadim, and I'll call for you. We never hear of her calling for him. Or maybe she did, but we don't know. We don't hear it. Maybe she did. And he calls them out to come to the Sadeh. Why to the Sadeh? Because he's afraid that Lavan's going to hear. Which means Rivka is always listening in and hearing. Lavan is always listening in and hearing. And Yaakov knows now that Lavan is the one who always listens and hears. And therefore he preempts this by going out to the field to make sure that Lavan won't be able to hear. So I'm saying is that Yaakov ends up having a lot more Lavan in him. It was in his mother. Esav doesn't have that. Esav's a bull. Esav goes straight forward, says what he's thinking, right? Whether he always carries it out is something else, but that goes back to the personality. Going back to the last thing which is concerning me, and that is the curse. She says, don't worry, right? The curse will be upon me. So a number of the commentaries here connect this back to her original prophecy. You can take your pick where you want 18, we'll look at 18. The curse will be on me. Ki hatabo tachat b'masha amr lo ha-kadosh baruch hu v'rav yovad se'ir. That what motivates her is that original prophecy that she was told, and that's what's taking place. Now, what did I do today that I hope you all noticed? I showed that the language from that original prophecy, or at least the theme from the original prophecy, of the older and the younger, is all over this chapter over here, and I think that that lends a lot of support for what the Rashbam says over here. It's not just the Rashbam, it's most of the Baalei HaTosfot that we have, who have commentaries, which includes the Chizkuni, the Bechoshor, the Moshe Skenim, the Datz Skenim, the Perish Baalei HaTosfot, all of those realize, 19 till 23, are all coming from one school of thought, and they all say similar things, although not necessarily all of them identical, and they also bring some interesting things. Look at source 21 for a moment. Back on Verav Yovad Seir, Hikshur Rav Rav Shmuel, Hechala Belibo Otot Tzadik Levarechet Esav Vaktiv. Doesn't he know this? V'yesh Lomo Yitzchak Lo Yoda, which is the thing always bothering. Doesn't Yitzchak know? And he says no. Yitzchak never knew about any of this. So let's continue a little bit more. The Tzvor Hamor in 24. Connects the two deeds of Yaakov together, the taking of the birthright and the taking of the bracha, and we'll leave that if you would like to look at it. Source 25 is the Malbim. So we've skipped a whole bunch of centuries. The Malbim likes to ask a bunch of questions, and then he likes to give a bunch of answers, and hopefully his answers answered his questions, but I want you to see his question. Mara Yitzchak Levrechet Esav Dafka Velot Yaakov. Doesn't he know that he's the good guy and he's the bad guy? Okay, I wrote this. I didn't find anybody at the point that I wrote it, and I'll have to put a footnote in. I came to this realization that Rivka may never had intended for Yaakov to take the bracha, because you can't steal a bracha. It's not going to work. But the whole purpose over here was never for Yaakov to get the bracha. But what was the purpose? That Esav doesn't get it. You don't want to give nuclear arms to somebody who's a really bad guy. It's not going to work. Yaakov is not going to get these blessings. If you take a look, now you won't have to read the article I wrote in Hebrew. If you take a look at next week's parsha, when Yaakov meets God, and God speaks to him, apparently for the first time, and he reiterates the bracha that he got from Yitzchak, you're going to get Eretz Yisrael, you're going to come back, I'm giving you this, and he never repeats the bracha that he had stolen. That bracha, God's silent about that. And you know what God is saying to him in the silence? That you can't steal a bracha. But if you can't steal a bracha, so what's the objective of the whole thing? So the Malbim, in his question, I don't know if he really answers this. I looked through quickly, but I didn't see him answering this. But he's in the question, what made Rivka want to prevent Esav to get... That's it. That's the answer. His question is the answer. What made Rivka want to prevent Esav from getting the bracha? And the answer is because it's Esav. It's not that Yaakov was ever going to get it. It's let's make sure that Esav does get it. How does that work that you steal a bracha? I'm going to say it again. What's the answer? It doesn't work. Like, what's going on over here? This is all part of the questions that he asks. And then he says afterwards in the third line, and Masha Amar Rivka, when Rivka says, the curse will be upon me, can you really take a curse from somebody else? The Malbim then says something in when he gives the answer in source 26, which I am totally unconvinced about. The curse will be on me, Ratzaloma, be'im yirtzulakalcha, tomar, but if he wants to curse you, tell him that I commanded you to do this. This is not about you. Just tell Yitzchak, it's not about you. Tell him if he has a problem, come to me. Which is interesting. I mean, that's a response. Not that the curse won't come on you. Answer him. Say, I commanded you. And let him get upset with me. And tell him that I command you to do it, not because you wanted this, not because you're concerned with this bracha, but rather simply you are listening to your mother. And once he realizes it's coming from me, he'll realize I did not mislead you. And also, additionally, you can tell him, finally, that I had a prophecy, and what I'm telling you over here comes back to that prophecy, and therefore her meaning. It's beautiful the way he's weaving all of this. He's saying he's not going to curse you, but not because I can control the curse, but rather you can have a conversation with him. And the conversation is going to run something like this. My mother told me to do it, and she sent a message and saying she had a prophecy, and she over here is fulfilling the prophecy, and this is the word of God. Again, there's all kinds of questions you can all ask on this, but it's interesting the way that the Malbim is dealing with this potential curse. And therefore, she says, it's on me, kiline emar kein b'nevuah. So therefore, according to this, even this point goes back to that original nevuah, and it's quite probable that the Malbim over here is channeling that unculus where he touched the nevuah, even though I will admit that when I read the unculus, it sounded to me like there was a new nevuah and not going after the old one. And the way that the Netziv understands this in source number 27 is, again, listen to what I'm telling you. Vishma bikoli b'teda ki beruach hakodesh ineni medaber v'yodea nishetzliach inyan. Everything I'm telling you is based upon Ruach HaKodesh, and everything is going to be successful. Go ahead. And I'll say it again. Yeah, and I'll say it again. God has a say in this as well. Just check the blessing that he took, if it ever really comes to Yaakov. I mean, if it did, where's all your money? Okay, let me finish. No Esav behavior here. No immediate gratification. Delayed gratification. Okay? The Siftei Kohen you can read on your own. It's a Kabbalistic commentary. And he speaks about how magically the clothing of Esav fits Yaakov, but Esav was much bigger, and that was the test to see. The Benah Gadol, Benah Katan, he plays with all of this. And therefore, it's Cinderella, the shoe fits, and therefore it's very... Anybody wants Cinderella in the Parsha, then you can read Source 28. I can imagine someone can give a whole shiur based on this, okay? But we won't. Source 29 is the Gra, and the Gra says something which is haunting. I can't decide if we're going to use the word haunting or chilling. We'll start with haunting. And it goes back, can you really say, don't worry, you won't be cursed? So again, if this wasn't the Gra, then you would start up with me and say, how can you say such a thing? But of course the Gra's right. Yaakov's worried that he's going to get cursed. Now he ends up taking a blessing, and he will be blessed, as you said. All that's right, except for look what the Gra says. Again, we're not going to read the whole thing, and he doesn't say it over here. He says it in Perek Membet, verse 29, Kol Eliyahu from the Gra. Vayomer Elayim Yaakov, Yosef Inenu, Vishimon Inenu, right? So now we've skipped far, far away and look to where it's underlined. And he's going back, the line before it's underlined. Acha kavanah haya ki Rivka hodiya liYaakov, shelo yavo alav tzarot ki im shlosha, eilu harimozim b'milat alai. What's alai stand for? It's Ayin Lamed Yud, Esav, Lavan, and Yosef. Tzorat Esav, Tzorat Lavan, Tzorat Yosef. Umilot Alai, Roshe Tevot, Esav, Lavan, Yosef. She says, don't worry. Any curse will be Alai. And what does the Gra say Alai means? Well, look at his life. He ends up now having to confront Esav, who's going to come after him. He's coming back to get him. And that will cause a great deal of trouble in his life. He's going to be dealing with Lavan for the next 20 years or so. I mean, Lavan's the one guy who we've said many times you would never buy a used car from, or probably much other things from him. And he's going to have to deal with him, which is going to completely ruin his life. And then the whole tzara that he ends up having with Yosef, which means if you go through the rest of his life, Yaakov's life is ruined by this. Yaakov is a nice man who sits in the tents and lives with his parents and lives in the same neighbor and lives up the block. And the rest of the story should have been somebody bring him a wife and let him sit and live in tranquility. Yaakov bikesh l'shevet b'shalva. Yaakov wants to live in tranquility, but it doesn't happen. And the rest of his life ends up becoming cursed. Or if you prefer, you want to call it challenges. Troubled challenges, difficulties. Yaakov has a difficult life. And if I look at the different periods of his difficulty in his life, so essentially what do we have? So essentially we have the Esav problem, and we have the Lavan problem, and we have the Yosef problem. And Rivka says, no, don't worry. Any curse will be a lie. So now the only question then comes up, so what in the world did the word a lie mean? So you would have thought as you're reading it, don't worry, everything will be okay. Yeah, so let's get to the conclusion there. So let's get to the conclusion. The conclusion is that everything's complicated. There's many... the relationships here are very complicated. Rivka seems all the way through motivated because she has inside information, which is prophecy. So it's very hard to argue with this. Yitzchak is a wonderful parent who sees the flaws of Esav, who knows who Esav is, knows who Yaakov is, and he tries to create Esav to become somebody who can work together with Yaakov, because that combination could be unstoppable. Yaakov, for his part, loves Esav and wants to protect him, and because he knows he's just not as capable, and let me help you. And maybe he helps too much, which is actually interesting, because you never noticed before Yosef being in Yaakov. Because this is a total Yosef behavior that he does. I'll take care of everything. I'll run everything. I'll do everything. And then what do you end up getting from the other brothers? Resentment. Who are you to do everything? Why are you doing everything? Because you need me to do everything. But we don't want to need you. But this becomes really interesting because you never noticed, Ela toldot Yaakov Yosef, you never noticed Yosef's personality of looking out for his brothers to the point that his brothers hate him for it, going all the way back to that relationship between Yaakov and Esav. And I'll say it again, I believe it's the exact same thing, that Yaakov loves Esav and therefore wants to protect him, and he wants to protect his father from knowing about this, just like Yosef ends up never telling his father about the sale because he wants to protect his father from knowing how his brothers really behaved. And now you realize that all of this is there already, and that's why he's never afraid of Esav, because he thinks that Esav loves him the same way that he loves him, but that's not what happened. We end up getting this resentment which got built up and ends up that Esav gets the point that he wants to kill him, just like what ended up happening with Yosef, which means this point of the Vilna Gaon is so scary because look what happens at the end. That Yaakov's life, not only does this, again, whether it's worth it or not worth it, because I believe Yosef would say the same thing. Yosef would say that every step of the way was worth it because this was the word of God. This is the way it was supposed to happen. But now you realize that not only was this supposed to happen in Yosef, but all of that happens first with Yaakov, and then will get played out afterwards. But if anybody wants to know any more, you either have to read the end of the book or come back next week.